Today is Monday. It's November 23rd, 2020. This is a Part 9 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Carl. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing real well.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Super. Thank you. We finished up Part 8. You were, you had just transferred to Petrified Forest National Park in the winter 1985, 1986, like December.
Yeah, December of 86.
And landed as the resource manager for the park.
Right.
Which was a, thank heavens, it just sounded like such a great change to get out of interpretation, same questions day in, day out. Suddenly something new, and you were totally new to. Could you pick that thread up?
Sure. Like I was talking to you before we started, I think the best thing to do is just kind of go through and talk about some of the different projects rather than to try and do things in chronological order, just do it by subject matter instead.
Okay.
And we had talked, or at least mentioned a little bit about the IPM stuff. I think we covered the air quality responsibilities of that job pretty well last time.
Yeah.
But IPM stands for Integrated Pest Management. And the Park Service was just kind of starting out with trying to implement a robust integrated pest management program. You know, rather than going out and just spraying insecticides or herbicides or whatever, to take a look at what it was we were trying to control, why they were there, and what were our options to get rid of them.
Oh, okay.
That could be applying some kind of poison, but it could be something as simple as exclusion, you know, mouse proof in your house so the mice just can't get in the first place.
Right.
Or things like that. And I was the park IPM person, which meant I had to get training on pesticide applications and those sorts of things. Had to go to different training. And at one point, the Park Service had worked up a deal with the Department of Defense. They were real big on IPM as well, and got us some slots to monitor or to attend some of their training.
Oh, wow!
And so I got to do one of those. It was a DOD class that was given in Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. And it was a 2-week class, and there were, I would guess, probably about a half dozen Park Service folks, and then a lot of military contractors who had the contract for doing pest management on military bases and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And it was quite a big deal for us to be able to attend this class, and I'm not sure if the Park Service ever did it again.
Ooh.
Our feedback on it was fairly scathing. It was a good IPM class, probably for the military, but you know, we weren't storing food for the troops. We weren't maintaining golf courses for the general, and things like that. And that was the sort of thing that they were really into. So we got some applicable training.
Okay.
But it certainly didn't justify the 2 weeks that we were gone.
Mm.
So at Petrified Forest, we really didn't have much in the way of pest management. I never had to treat for bed bugs or anything like that. The concessioner, of course, had a kitchen, so that meant that there were problems. The two just pretty much go together. But they had a contractor. So what I did was, you know, I would work with the contractor to approve whatever pesticides they wanted.
I see.
Make suggestions for less toxic alternatives and that kind of stuff. So probably the biggest IPM project that I had hands-on was trying to control tamarisk in the park, the salt cedar, introduced from probably the Near East back in the late 1800s as an ornamental shrub and erosion control. But pretty much anybody in the Southwest who has to do land management has to battle tamarisk. They're just incredibly invasive shrubs. They just suck up the water from intermittent streams and springs and that kind of stuff. And we had a fair amount of infestation. There's no surface water in petrified forest, but a lot of dry washes. And they were pretty much, if not lined with tamarisk, there was a lot of tamarisk there.
Huh.
And so we worked to get rid of them. And basically that we would get a YCC crew, high school kids for the most part, and they would go out and using loppers and that kind of stuff, they would cut the tamarisk and then treat the cut stumps with an herbicide to kill the roots. And the first year we did it for the whole time I was there. The first year we had pretty poor results, and we discovered that tamarisk, besides being incredibly invasive, is hard to kill, and you have to get the herbicide on to the cut stump immediately after it's cut.
Wow.
Otherwise, the sap kind of scabs it over, and then the herbicide isn't absorbed.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
So we didn't do that the first year. We'd come in, we'd lop off all the branches on a shrub, and then I'd come in and we didn't have high school kids putting on the herbicide. That was my job.
Got it.
Or my assistant, and but we didn't get it on fast enough, and so there was a lot of regrowth. In the following years, we had much better results. And actually, over the course of that time, we were able to get rid of tamarisk along an entire major drainage in the central part of the park, and make inroads on some other drainages as well.
Wow!
There was a clump of tamarisk in that central drainage, but not along a wash, and. We thought that, the fact that it was there indicated there was subsurface water. And we thought it was the location of an old spring that was shown on some of the really early maps of the park. And sure enough, we got rid of the tamarisk, and the spring came back up again.
Oh, wow.
And it didn't produce a stream, but at least there was a tiny little pool of water there.
Huh.
The other thing that we discovered was that once you killed the mature tamarisk, the reproduction is pretty easy to do. Up until the tamarisk are about 2 years old, you can actually just pull them up.
Okay.
They have a very fast-growing root system, but where they were growing in petrified forest was in these sandy washes.
Hmm.
And so you could come through and just pull them up. And they might have a 10-foot root, but it was all in this loose sand, so you could just, it was kind of like coiling up an extension cord.
It was easy to pull up.
Yeah, you just get a good grip on it and walk along and tug it all out. One of the kind of amusing things that happened was one year I was driving up through the park. The crew was working back behind a mesa, maybe a mile and a half east of the road, and I come around this curve, and there's this pillar of flame coming up from behind this mesa. Immediately got on the radio to see what was going on, and they had just piled up all the cut tamarisk in the wash, and lit it on fire.
Oops.
And it was just the right size that it all pretty much went up at once. And so after that, we burned smaller piles of pond.
Okay.
But so that was my big pest management job. And it actually morphed into another part of my duties, which was dealing with endangered species. And I knew that we had one plant that it wasn't an endangered species, but it was a candidate for an endangered species. And the YCC program that the kids were enrolled in that were chopping the tamarisk was supposed to also provide some environmental education. So, you know, I'd go out and give them talks and all that kind of stuff. But I thought, oh, yeah, one day I should have these kids go out and look for this endangered plant.
Hmm.
And so I, on a trip up to the canyon, I had stopped by the museum in northern Arizona. They had some specimens of it in their herbarium. So I just made Xerox copies of the herbarium specimens, which was very effective. It kind of surprised me when Art Phillips said, oh, well, just take the specimen and Xerox it.
Just lay it down on the Xerox machine and hit copy.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. So I had these nice pictures of it. I sent them out. I made some, you know, made copies of it. Said, okay, here's the plant you're looking for. We think it's, we have a recording that it has been seen somewhere near Agate Bridge, one of the stops on the park road. So I'd say start there and see what you find. Well, the end of the day came back, and they said, well, we found some. And I said, great, how many? And it turned out that they had, like, tripled the world's population of this plant.
Wow.
Right next to the parking lot.
Wow.
At Agate Bridge in the park.
And do you think,
well, this is pretty phenomenal.
Why do you think it was there by the parking lot?
Well, as it turned out, as we did more research, and then I was also working with a guy who was employed by the Navajo tribe, because it was also found on the up on Navajo Nation.
Okay.
What we finally decided, looking at the distribution in the park and up on the res, was that it was a plant that liked disturbance, but it couldn't withstand any grazing. So we would find it in disturbed areas, but only areas that weren't grazed, like the park wasn't grazed. And eventually it was taken off the candidate list because we found so much of it in the national park.
Wow.
And it was the one amusing thing that came out of it was, I'll put out a monthly summary of resource management happenings in the park and that kind of stuff. It was started out as just a report to my boss of what I was doing, but he says, you know, you should just let the whole staff know what you're doing. So I kind of modified the format around and then distributed it. And I told him about finding all these astragalus plants at Agate Bridge. And the guy in charge of roads came to me the next day, and he goes, my God, we go through and we mow that area like twice a year. What are we supposed to do now? And I said, well, you know, it's the world's largest population of the plant.
Keep it up.
Keep mowing it twice a year and keep them going.
Well, that's weird, because you'd think that mowing would be similar to grazing. So what kind of disturbance do they like?
Yeah.
That's complicated.
Usually we would find them growing along washes, you know, where they'd get beat up by flash floods and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So we never, you know, it was kind of a case of we came to that conclusion, but we don't know if it was coincidence or causality.
Hmm.
Never took it that far, at least while I was there. So I
wonder if you know, something like cattle actually really hammered them, because maybe cattle found them good to eat.
It could be that the seeds couldn't survive the digestive tract. When they could get they'd survive a flash flood, but not a cow's rumen or something like that. So just really, really don't know about that.
I mean, just thinking about the megafauna of the Pleistocene, there would have been a lot of big creatures looking for food, and and the stragglers survived that. So what was the disturbance difference? It's curious.
Yep. It was good news for the plant, but kind of a puzzle as to why.
Yeah. Well, good. At least it has a refuge there.
Yep. So we worked on that.
What did you tell the maintenance guys?
I told them to keep mowing.
Okay.
You know,
so just keep disturbing it.
Yeah, the plants are doing great.
Okay.
So keep doing what you're doing.
Great.
Yeah, let's see. Other things I was in charge of were, I was in charge of the backcountry, which...
Can we hang on just a minute to the integrated pest management?
Oh, okay.
When I think of IPM, I think of mice, rats, termites, the sort of household pets, lizards in window screens, birds in houses, mice in the Yavapai observation station that get free rides out of trash cans and go paragliding. Did you have to deal with that as well? Just not on as big a scale as tamarisk.
It was a pretty minor part of the job. Like I said, the concessioner had a contractor who handled their pest management. So I worked with the contractor, just to make sure that he was using pesticides that the Park Service had approved, and that they were. Okay, what else are you doing? Are you, you know, keeping the place clean so there's less food for the pests to eat and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Another issue that we had that was kind of related to that was we had a researcher that was in studying prairie dogs in the park.
Oh.
And he was studying a prairie dog town that was just right adjacent to the one of the housing areas, maybe a couple hundred yards from the housing area, and it was a massive research project. The guy's name was John Hoogland, and he would get all these graduate students to come out every summer, and he'd set up these towers, and he would trap all the prairie dogs in the town. And then he would use shoe polish and dye their fur in distinctive patterns so he could identify individual prairie dogs. And then the graduate students would spend all day long sitting up in these towers monitoring the behavior of the prairie dogs.
Huh.
And it was, you know, there were some interesting results that came out of that. One was that prairie dogs are cannibals. One prairie dog will go into a nest and eat the pups. And kind of a question as to why they do that.
Yeah.
If it's that they need the extra nutrition for lactation or just what it is. But he was worried because prairie dogs are very susceptible to bubonic plague. And there is plague in northeastern Arizona.
Yep.
And so he wanted to prophylactically just dust the burrows with an insecticide to kill fleas, because fleas are the vector of bubonic plague. And we went round and round on that, and it's like, no, we just can't do that. That's just a little bit too far. Not a strong enough need for a dispersal of such a powerful insecticide out there.
And fleas have been around, since the Pleistocene, and prairie dogs have been around since the Pleistocene, and plague has been around. So wouldn't, am I wrong on that? Or because
plague apparently came over here if I remember right, this is something that somebody should Google rather than taking my word for it.
Okay.
But as I recall, it came over in the 1880s from China. And
so it's new to the New World.
Right, right. And that's, and you know, prairie dogs have just a horrible reputation for plague.
Hmm.
And it's not because they spread it so much, but it's that they live in these social, you know, intensely social, huge colonies. So that once plague gets into a prairie dog town, it just spreads like wildfire.
Oh,
and
wow.
They have very little resistance to it.
Okay.
And so one thing we did do was worked with the state, because I had contacted the Department of Environmental Quality about it.
Hmm.
And they said, you know, their recommendation was, well, we'll monitor for plague. And that was a case of a couple times a year, a guy from DEQ would come up, and he and I would go out into the prairie dog town and trap fleas, and then which is actually pretty easy to do. You just put a white rag on a stick and shove it down into the prairie dog hole. And I don't, well, you breathe on the rag first so that it's got some CO2 around it.
Hmm.
It smells like a mammal. Shove it down into the hole, pull it back out, and shake the fleas out into a Ziploc. And,
wow.
And then he would take them down to Phoenix and test them for plague. And we lucked out. The whole time that that Dr. Hoogland was doing his work in the park, that town did remain plague-free.
Hmm.
And so he was able to complete his research. And kind of in the nick of time, a couple of years later, plague did get into that town. And it's last I heard, it was extinct. Prairie dog towns tend to be recolonized eventually. But last I heard, that one was extinct.
Wow.
Which was a big relief to the maintenance crew.
Hmm.
Because not only was it near the housing area, but it was also near the sewage lagoons for the housing area. And they were worried about the prairie dogs digging a burrow that would tap into the sewage lagoons and draining one of them.
Mm.
So
yeah.
That never happened either.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it all worked out well. We got some good research, and it all worked out.
Hmm. Wow.
So let's see. Oh, I mentioned that I was quote unquote in charge of the backcountry. Petrified Forest has designated wilderness in it, and we did allow overnight backpack camping in the designated wilderness area. We'd get, oh, as I recall, maybe 20 or 30 people a year who would actually go backpacking into the wilderness. And
I'm thinking mostly in the winter when it was kind of cool.
Actually, not so much the wintertime, because the soils there are essentially clay, that badland clay.
Okay.
And it is impossible to walk through.
Okay.
So it would be, quite often it'd be in the fall.
Okay.
The temperatures had come down and you could walk around.
Hmm.
And I would say a good half of them were folks that had figured that, oh, well, there'll be a campground in the national park. And there wasn't one, but they were prepared to go backpacking, and it was only a couple of miles of walking to get to the wilderness area. So they'd, you know, get a gallon or two of water and hike out there and backpack just because they wanted to spend the night.
Okay.
We had one couple that got a wilderness permit. Then when they were doing the closing patrol at night, chasing everybody out of the park at closing time, they came on this motorhome that was all set up in the picnic area. And they said, no, you folks are going to have to leave. And, oh, no, we have a wilderness permit. And they thought that since there was no hookups, it qualified as wilderness.
Uh-huh.
They could set up their motorhome for the night.
Oh, my gosh.
I was like, no. So I did set up a program in DBase 3, which was the database program at the time, to track the we'd use it to issue the permits and then track the use levels. But we never had to set up like a reservation program or anything like that. Huh. I think we did have use limits on how many people could camp in the wilderness, but I doubt we even came within an order of magnitude of how many people were supposedly allowed out there.
And what's the acreage involved of the wilderness area?
The wilderness area, grand total, was about 50,000 acres.
Oh, that's a good chunk of land.
Yeah, most of it was in the northern end of the park in the Painted Desert. There was a smaller, about 5,000 acre unit in the southern end of the park.
Okay.
And then the rest of the park, at that time the park was about 94,000 acres.
Okay.
And then the rest of the park was backcountry and was, with some small exceptions, was available for day use. There were a couple of areas that were closed for day use, but very few. You know, Petrified Forest is almost entirely a drive-through park. We had some loop trails, little nature trails at different overlooks. The longest one was about a mile long, but most people were just driving through on their way to Grand Canyon or Vegas or Disneyland or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Huh.
So I was doing the tracking and stuff on wilderness use.
Did you get a chance to get out in that 50,000 acre some yourself?
I did. One of the things I did later on in my tenure there, I started getting an inventory together of where things were in the park, and it was partly based on the park's general management plan, which I should also talk about.
Okay.
I actually made it a point to hike to places that I hadn't been before, and kind of keep a record of what was out there, whether it was archaeology or paleontology or just the plants and that kind of stuff that were growing there. And then I had a database of it. I guess you could call it a GIS. It was I had a record for each section, each square mile in the park. And then in that database for each section, there would be a listing of what cultural resources were there, paleontological resources, botanical, and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And my thought was that, GIS was first starting to become practicable. And so when it came time to replace my computer, I got a 40 megabyte hard drive on my computer.
40 megabyte?
40 megabytes.
Well, think how big that is. Wow.
Yeah, it was. I had to partition the disk because at that time DOS couldn't handle 40 megabytes at once. People were just incredulous. They said, why do you need 40 megabytes? And it's like, well, I might want to do GIS, of course. Now GIS works in terabytes. So
exactly. multiple terabytes, yeah.
Yeah, but in the late 1980s, megabytes was pretty cutting edge.
Had you worked with computers at Grand Canyon? Were you aware? I think they had one in 86 or no, it was in the early 80s. They had some sort of weird computer thing that could do some stuff.
Yeah, I did do a little bit of computer work at Grand Canyon before I went to Petrified Forest. Of course, those were the days of, well, when I was at Grand Canyon, it was I think they were 8-inch floppy disks.
Okay.
And I did just a little bit of word processing on it. But then at Petrified Forest, we've gone to the 5 1/4-inch floppy disks and eventually down to the little guys, the 3 1/2-inch floppies. And it was the system where you couldn't afford to waste memory on programs.
Okay, right.
You'd have the dual floppies, and one of them would have a program disk in it, and the other one would have a data disk.
Okay.
And one of the tricks of maintaining databases was that I was actually pretty good with DBase 3. And so rather than just entering stuff into the computer in English, I would write entry programs so that you would have a list. It would say, you know, choose one from this list. And so instead of saying that, okay, section 35 has Shortgrass Prairie, section 35 has A. Or if it was a salt bush community, it might be B or something like that.
Okay.
So I, instead of having to write those things out and take up all that memory that I didn't have, I would just need a letter or two. So I did get pretty good at computers. I used DBase 3, and then we also did our budget work on spreadsheets, and then we did word processing. We used a program called Symphony, which was based off of Lotus 1-2-3.
Okay.
For the spreadsheet program, and then it had a word processor. And it also had a database, but we didn't use that database because DBase 3 was better.
Hmm.
Okay. So I was, you know, gradually computerizing some of that stuff.
Wow. And I wonder where that is now. I mean, that's the thing about that. You have to go from 8-inch floppies. You have to transfer all that stuff to 5 1/4, and then the 3 1/2, and then off to CDs, and then, or before that was zip drives, and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's thumb drives, yeah, and up in the cloud, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I may still have the backups that I made on my computer around here someplace, because you'd have to find a machine that could read them and the legacy programs. But
exactly,
that's the other problem that you run into with these.
Yeah.
With these things.
Not like the. The 1920 brochure that you found written in English 1.0 that just needs sunlight and still works.
Yeah, mm-hmm, precisely.
Interesting.
And that's actually one of the things that I would periodically do, like the database. I would, before I left Petrified Forest, there were a couple of things, and that database was one of them, the LANS database. Where I've just printed it out. I formatted up some reports, and then I printed it out, so each one of the however many sections it was, I think it was around 150 square miles, but each square mile or portion thereof that was within the park had a page that printed out the database record, so there'd be a hard copy of it.
Right. Clever. And then at least you could just save that data so somebody could, in theory, go back and do data entry.
Right.
If they found the document, then, yeah.
Yeah. So that was, there was that. Let's see, I was in charge of special park uses, which is basically permits. I managed the collecting permits for the researchers. We had right-of-way permits and... special use permits and that kind of stuff for, like power lines and phone lines that cross the park and those sorts of things.
Did anybody ask for a special use permit to get married out there?
No, we did that without a special use permit.
Really?
Yeah. It was, the first summer I was there, we just said, Lori and I are going to get married and we'd like to use the Painted Desert Inn. And the superintendent said, okay. And so that's what we did.
What year was that?
That would have been in 1987.
Oh, fun.
And so we got the place all cleaned up and used the, we were using the old curio shop. So the big upstairs room was where we had the wedding, and then the old Fred Harvey Snack Bar was where we held the reception, and we cleaned up the kitchen enough. We didn't actually cook in the kitchen. There were the restrooms worked, but there was no electricity, and so So all the food preparation was done ahead of time and then just brought up there and that sort of thing.
Cool.
But, as far as we know, other people have gotten married on the rim of the Painted Desert, but Lori and I are the only ones that got married actually within the Painted Desert Inn.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
So, yep. Yeah, we got married in September, then took off to Alaska for our honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
So, and...
did you go back to some of the same haunts that you'd been to years earlier?
A few. We went up. It was actually kind of amusing. We got married there in the Painted Desert Inn, and then that night, one of our wedding presents was our first night was in one of the really nice resorts in Scottsdale.
Oh wow!
Which we got into like at 10 o'clock at night, and it was actually turned out to be nicer than had been anticipated because the Pope was coming to Phoenix the next day. And so my sister-in-law had reserved us the space in this resort. And she said, you know, I should go back and check on that. And what with the Pope coming and all. So she went back and checked on it and said, oh, no, we don't have a reservation for that. And she says, oh, yes, you do. And pulled out all the paperwork. And they had to... they'd already given away all their all the rooms like that, so they had to bump us up into a really nice suite with a hot tub and everything.
Oh my gosh!
And so we had a real nice place. We got in, and I would say we were there for like maybe 10 hours before our flight left for Alaska. So we went from real nice luxury resort in Scottsdale to the Super 8 for our second night in Ketchikan, Alaska. And then our third night, we were in sleeping bags on deck chairs on the state ferry. but we did go up to Skagway. And Skagway, just in the not quite 10 years since I've been there, 10 years since I've been there, had changed quite a bit. The highway had been completed into Skagway.
Okay.
Pretty much put the railroad out of business, but the park had stabilized and opened up a lot more historic buildings, and Skagway was much more a tourist destination than it had been. But we went to Skagway and Juneau and then out to Sitka, which was one of the places that I had wanted to go when I was up there that summer, but my days off and the ferry schedule never meshed up. So we got to go over to Sitka as well.
Neat. Did you see any northern lights?
Trying to think. It seems like we did. The most spectacular northern lights I ever saw was when I was living up there.
Mm. Yeah.
But I'm thinking that we did.
Neat. And was Lori still work? She was still working at Petrified at the time?
Right. She was, at that time, she was the district interpreter for the north end of the park, the Painted Desert end of the park.
Okay.
And she was also working with the study collection and museum collection for the park. And at that time, the Park Service was starting to institute a computer-based collections program.
Okay.
And I had when I worked in Skagway and then came to Denver to do the artifact analysis, we'd been puttering around with the very, very early stages of that. And by the time she was working on it, it was a full-fledged program where they could enter records into it, but it was still in the testing phase. And Petrified Forest was selected because we had a real active research program, and we had paleontological resources, and they wanted to get a park with good geology and paleontology rather than the historical parks that made up the bulk of the test sites.
All right.
So she was very much involved with that.
Cool.
And so we would work together as well on the researchers, getting them to getting the things that they collected accessioned, which was new for a lot of them.
Okay.
And some of them thought it was worthwhile, and some of them didn't. But there was wonderful research going on in the park, but we were bureaucratizing that research, for better or for worse, and making sure that the things that they collected, that we had records of it, and could track both the objects that they collected and also the research that they were doing. And I had the Cooperating Association of Petrified Forests every year would provide funding for researchers coming into the park. Didn't support their entire research program, but it was enough to, you know, give them enough for groceries.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Cooperating Association would rent one of the three-bedroom houses that then became a researcher dorm.
Okay.
For the summer. And basically what I could do was I would work with the Cooperating Association with Lori and with the reports that I had to get as resource management specialist. And we'd tell them, you know, yeah, you're not going to get anything from the Museum Association until we have all of the records straight. Last year's research report and the listing of all of the artifacts and that kind of stuff.
Well, that would make sense. You know, give us the data of what you found last year before you start this year.
Right. And we had one researcher who'd been working in the park for a while and just wasn't getting around to doing that. And I finally told him, you know, hey. You're going to have a real rough time working here this summer if you don't get this stuff to me. Oh, the association will give me the money. And I told him, not if I don't tell them to.
Hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that. And it was about a week and a half later that I got his reports.
Good.
So, you know, it was, yeah. And others of them, you know, they just couldn't wait because it was their... My guess is that then they could also show those off to the university or whatever.
And yeah, as a work product. Yeah. Did Lori, working with the museum collection, did she keep the park archives? You know, superintendent's letters and maintenance reports and law enforcement logs and that sort of stuff.
I don't think so. I don't. I think we had an archive at the time.
Okay. I wonder where that stuff would go.
I know that we were, one of the things that she was involved with was setting up we had the typical park library at Petrified Forest. It was pretty small.
Okay.
But, you know, library of, you know, Indians of the Southwest and, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
But, they worked on getting a research library for the Triassic period.
Oh, interesting.
Together with just literally hundreds, probably a couple thousand scientific papers. And she was working with different researchers and that kind of stuff to fill out that library.
Nice.
To get the stuff in it so that these guys could come out in the park. But, of course, this was in the days before the Internet, but still have access to a lot of the scholarly papers that had been published so they could refer to them while they were working.
Yeah. Huh.
So that was going on. Let's see. Oh, cultural resources. I mentioned before that I worked very closely with Trinkle Jones down at the Western Archaeological Center in Tucson.
Right.
And so some of the researchers that we had in the park were archaeologists. And there was a rock art group, and they wanted to record rock art within the park, which was great. Petrified Forest has a tremendous amount of ancestral Pueblo and rock art. And... but she also told him, well, yeah, you can record the rock art like you want to, but I also want you to do a survey. And so they did a survey, archaeological survey of the park boundary for a quarter mile in from the boundary around the entire park.
Wow.
And that that was great, just in terms of identifying all the different sites along the park boundary, because of course those were the most vulnerable ones,
right?
And so they were out doing all that work, and one day, just kind of an interesting incident, Trinkle could pretty much just run that program. So if I had something of a cultural nature that would come up, what I would do is basically get on the phone and talk to her and say, okay, what do we do? And then she'd give me my marching orders. And so one day, somebody had found a skull eroding out of a sand dune near the park boundary. And so it's kind of like, okay, this is a big deal. We'll call up Trinkle. And she says, okay, well, I'm gonna get in touch with the Hopi tribe, because at that time the Hopi were the only ones who had established an ancestral relationship with Petrified Forest National Park.
Okay.
And I'll call up the Hopi and see what they want to do, and I'll call you back. And so a couple hours later, she called me back, and we did have a team that was doing some excavations in the park. I think they were doing some stabilization work down at the Puerco Pueblo in the middle of the park, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, we did have a couple of archaeologists in the park working from ASU.
Okay.
And so they said, okay, those guys need to go up and excavate the remains, and the Hopi will be sending down some of their elders. And when the elders get there, they should get there like at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and you do whatever they tell you to do. They'll probably want to rebury the remains nearby. And I said, okay, so we're going to be digging. And she says, yeah, you'll have to dig a hole, and you just do whatever they tell you to do. Their ancestor, whatever they tell you to do.
Wow, that's cool.
So that's what we did. They showed up, and they said, okay, no photographs, no sketches, no recording or anything like that. And so, okay. And so we went out to the site, and they had this person exhumed and just there right where they found him. And so the Hopi said, okay, this is great. You know, now you guys go over there behind that little hill, and we've got some stuff to do. We'll tell you when we're ready. So we go behind the hill, and we hear some chanting and that kind of stuff. But came back when they told us, and they said, okay, we're ready to rebury this person. And they lived in this pueblo over here. There was a little, very small site. Probably, my guess would be 3 or 4 room pueblo there. Just a mound. That's all we had left.
Mm-hmm.
But you could tell there were potsherds and stones and stuff. And I said, okay, we want the hole right here. And he points right in the middle of one of the rooms in this. And he says, just dig a hole like this deep. We'll tell you when to stop. And so it's kind of like, okay, this is, you know, this is an old house. I go, yeah, this is probably where he lives. That's where he needs to be.
Huh.
So there I am with my shovel, digging a hole in the middle of an archaeological site. You know, I can see the potsherds flying as I toss them out of the hole. And we get the hole dug, and then we put the remains back. We bury them, and then they blessed it. And then they walk over to the only juniper tree, probably within about 5 miles, and start ripping branches off of it. And it's kind of like, oh my God, anything they want. And they built a fire, which we didn't allow fires in the park, but they built a little campfire and then threw all these green juniper branches on it. And then we all took turns standing in the smoke while they blessed us so that we wouldn't have ghost dreams.
Cool.
About this whole incident. And I think it worked. I never had any ghost dreams.
Good.
But it was a very, it was actually very, very cool and very unusual sort of ceremony.
Yeah.
So let's see.
Very cool. And then you just buried the remains and filled the hole back up and.
Yep, and noted the site. Okay. So you know the site is you know the archaeological records for the park do say that that site was disturbed and.
Okay.
Whatever year that was, 1988 or whatever.
Uh huh.
It was disturbed to reinter.
Nice.
Reinter somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it just sounds so much better than you know, putting the remains behind a glass case where tourists get to gawk at it for years and years. And,
oh, yeah.
Or putting it in a drawer somewhere and they're calling it good there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. So, I'm trying to think. So, as resource manager, that kind of covers the stuff. I did get to go to various professional meetings. My boss Chris was he was very very much in tune with the idea that you know this is world class research going on in the park. You need to be able to talk to these guys. And so I would go to Geological Society of America meetings, Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meetings, one of which was held in Canada, which was kind of interesting. I put in my travel request for international travel, and it got lost in the regional office.
Oops.
And so I, to make a long story short, I was all packed up. I was ready to go. I was in the airport in Phoenix. While they were trying to rush this international travel request,
oh my gosh,
through to the Washington office, and they said, and I said, well, you know, I can just go on my own, and they said, no, you can't. If we don't approve it, you can't get on that plane, even if you pay for it yourself.
Wow.
And so I'm there in the boarding area, and they're boarding my flight, and it's kind of like one last call to the Washington office, and they said, okay, yep, the assistant secretary or whoever it was just signed it, so you can go.
Wow.
And so I was the last one on the plane.
Wow.
But I did get to go to the meeting, which was at kind of a flagship Museum of Paleontology up in Alberta.
Huh?
The Drumheller Museum of, the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology.
How do you spell that?
Royal Tyrrell, T-Y-R-E-L-L, and then the town it's in was Drumheller, D-R-U-M-H-E-L-L-E-R.
Wow.
And we pretty much overwhelmed the town. It was, I had gone up a day early, again, because of the park's general management plan. The province of Alberta has a lot of oil and gas money.
Hmm.
And they had decided to invest some of it in this museum. And so it was a fabulous museum of paleontology. But then they also have a museum or a collection where they do preparation, you know, chipping the bones out of the blocks of rock and that kind of stuff. And we were looking at establishing something like that on a smaller scale at Petrified Forest. So it was kind of a two-pronged reason for me to go up there. One was to see how the facility operated, plus to attend the vertebrate paleontology meetings.
Cool.
So yeah, it was a very interesting trip.
It was neat that Chris supported you for that.
Yeah, it was. That's something that doesn't always happen. And So, but he was absolutely 100% behind that sort of thing.
Fun. Very cool.
So that was kind of my resource management job up there. Then in 1988, Chris left.
Who?
He got a job at the regional office in Philadelphia, and so I was suddenly promoted to acting chief ranger for a little over a year. And so all of a sudden I was in charge of everything, law enforcement, fee collection, interpretation, resource management, all that kind of stuff.
Wow. So did you have to continue your resource management jobs and do the acting chief ranger job? Wow.
Yep. I had, I did have a couple of summer helpers, and a couple of, I think we classified them as range technicians, to do some of the field work, basically to continue the tamarisk removal program. I got a couple of rangers trained up on running the air quality equipment, so that, you know, unless something really bad happened, why, I could let that ride. And a lot of the other projects just kind of went. You know, I would meet with the researchers and that kind of stuff, but I didn't get much done in the way of field work. The one thing that was really occupying my time was before Chris left, and then during that time, we were writing a new general management plan for the park. And
wow, I mean, suddenly it's like, okay, so now there's a GMB in the middle of all that.
Right. And I had been kind of running my own budget for the resource management program.
Okay.
But now suddenly I had, you know, the budget for close to half the park expenditures. And what I quickly discovered was that Chris had an excellent grasp of the finances, but it was almost all in his head.
Oh my gosh!
So I spent like the first month or two trying to reconstruct the division budget, just so I could know how much money I had, and working with the AO and all that kind of stuff to try and get all these pieces together. But working on the general management plan had started when I was resource management specialist, and then once I was acting chief ranger, why, it became a big part of my job. And we actually had some great plans. I'd mentioned that we wanted to recreate in miniature the kind of museum and collections and fossil preparation program there inside of the park. At the same time, the Bureau of Land Management, and I'm not sure why.
Hey, Carl.
Yeah.
I'm gonna jump right in here, and I'm gonna say, you know what? We've been going for almost an hour, and I want to know more about the AO and who was the superintendent, and why did Chris leave, and then what is a general management plan?
Okay.
And so I'm just like, wait a minute, I got a ton of questions to ask you, and we're going to run off the rails here. Maybe this is a good time to wrap this part 9 up, and we'll pick it up with part 10.
Okay.
And as you take the new acting chief ranger job.
Okay.
Because I kind of want to know how that happened. Basically, there would have been, you know, the head of maintenance could have taken that job. The head of interpretation, Lori, could have taken that job.
She wasn't the head. She was just district. So.
No, but you know, how did you get that job and not anybody else? I think there would be other people at the park who could have handled that job.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, so how did that assignment happen? Anyway, so I've got some questions, but I'm just thinking maybe we should pick this up to explore it more next time.
Okay. That works for me.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we will conclude part 9, Oral History with Carl Bowman. Today is Monday, November 23rd, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Carl, thank you so very much.
Certainly.